This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Democratic nominee John Kerry made his service in Vietnam the centerpiece of his speech to the Democratic National Convention and a cornerstone of his presidential campaign. He's been attacked by some veterans who say he exaggerated his record and who criticize his role as an anti-war leader in the 1970s. In an interview today with the Associated Press, presidential adviser Karl Rove said that Kerry tarnished the records and service of people who were defending our country, fighting communism, and doing what they thought was right. Other veterans argue that George W. Bush avoided service in Vietnam by joining the Texas Air National Guard. Almost 30 years after the fall of Saigon, why is what young men did and said during and after the war in Vietnam still such an issue? What does it tell us about them? What does it tell us about their times? And what does it tell us about politics today and the cultural divide? In particular, how does it play into the debates over Iraq? This hour, an extended conversation on Vietnam and how it shaped those who went and those who didn't. We'll talk with two people who were there, writer David Halberstam, the author of The Best and the Brightest, who covered the war for the New York Times, and with writer and former Secretary of the Navy James Webb, who served in the Marines as a platoon and company commander in Vietnam. We also want to hear from you, but we're going to wait a bit before we start taking calls. Joining us now by phone from Nantucket, Massachusetts, is David Halberstam, the Pulitzer Prize-winning author. He wrote an article about Vietnam for the most recent issue of Vanity Fair magazine. Good to have you back on the program, David.
Nice to be with you.
I want to start, let me ask you, you've done a lot before and after, particularly after Vietnam. Do you think it's still the defining experience of your life?
Well, it does. Yes, it does. I mean, it doesn't go away. I didn't think it would be if you'd asked me when I left there for the last time as a reporter in 1967, 37 years ago, that it would be still haunting all of us. I'd have been absolutely stunned. It's 42 years since I first went there, and I covered a lot of other big stories, but because of the tenaciousness of it, because of the divisions that have come from it, the fact that it still is the unfinished plate on the table, it is a defining part of my life because none of us is able to entirely get away from it.
In your article in Vanity Fair, you write how you were among the first to be challenged by government officials, including the President of the United States, for writing critically about the war. Tell us about those allegations.
Well, I wasn't pessimistic enough, I think, in retrospect, but I was pessimistic. I wasn't on the team, which was the then phrase, and what I was writing was that it was a first class. I think if you read it carefully, it was in a paper, a newspaper, the New York Times, it was much more powerful then than it is today because television had not yet come into its own. In fact, when I started, it was still a 15-minute news hour, a news show instead of a 30-minute color hadn't arrived. The Times was very important. Here was a reporter saying we were not winning, in fact, that we were losing and that it didn't work. And I think that was a political threat to the Kennedy administration. I don't think they cared that much about Vietnam. I think it's always been very cynical from the White House, from Washington. But I think when you put your political flag into something like that, you have a vested interest, and they had wanted to run against Barry Goldwater in '64 and win easily, and they wanted to keep Vietnam on the back burner and triumph by public relations, which was, I think, the main thing. And so I was a major irritant to them, and they went after my colleagues and me, I think, almost particularly because of the power of the Times. Mm-hmm. President Kennedy asked the publisher to transfer me, and Lyndon Johnson later, taking time from his other serious duties to be Minister of Truth, referred to my young colleague Neil Sheehan and me as traitors to our country. It got very ugly very early on.
And because, in part, of those challenges to your patriotism, you said you made a point of making sure that what you wrote was not perceived as an armchair.
I wasn't going to do armchair. My father had served as a medic in World War One and then as a combat surgeon in World War Two, and he had been dead 12 years when I first went there. He had died of a heart attack, and I was not going to let him down. I was going to honor our name. I was going to honor the particular profession, and I wasn't going to do anything that could be in any way not satisfactory in terms of the energy. And I had great sources throughout the country, senior American advisors to Vietnamese units all over, and they were all extremely negative about it. One of the sad things about Vietnam from there is that it's, you know, if the government of the United States had chosen to tell the truth, it would have been a lot easier than the complicated lying that thereupon went on.
And one of the things that you also write about was that the it was really the fault of policies and politicians rather than the troops in the field.
Well, I mean, the young men in the field were always, I think, extremely brave. We sent good kids there and under very difficult circumstances because we were really in the continuum of an anti-colonial war. So I feel we were eventually fighting the birth rate, but I had great respect for the people who went. One of the things that's upsetting, I mean, I noticed that one of the new charges that's going on against Senator Kerry is on the testimony before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and he did that, and I can understand why that is a enormously wounding to other people who fought there. But he spoke, it should be said, in a vacuum. The people who should have spoken and said, you know, in effect, this is the wrong war, the wrong time, the wrong place, were the people who were the architects, like Robert McNamara and George Bundy and others, who had long ago, 4 years earlier, turned on the war themselves but remained silent. And were not willing to come forward. They were cowards, really. They were timid and cowardly, and so they left a vacuum into which young men ended up having. Young men who were combat veterans had to sort of make the case that it was not the right war. I mean, that's the abdication of leadership on the part of those who knew best is one of the most painful things of this whole story.
Okay, David Halberstam, stay with us. Let's turn now to James Webb, the former Secretary of the Navy, the author of several books. He served in Vietnam with the Marines and joins us now by phone from Nashville, Tennessee, and it's good of you to be with us.
Yeah, well, thank you for having me.
Company commander, the 5th Marine Regiment in Vietnam. What was it like? Did you read reports of the war from people like David Halberstam?
I think it can probably fairly be said that in almost all of our wars, the actual combat environment is pretty apolitical. We had Armed Forces Vietnam radio that we would get in small transistor radios that people carried, and we would get Stars and Stripes, and you obviously had the letters from home and this sort of thing. I was in Vietnam in a threshold year, 1969, and it was after the peak year in terms of American casualties, 1968. The anti-war movement had begun more in earnest with the campaign of 68, and yet it was the second worst year for American casualties. So we had a feeling, a general feeling that things were not going in an affirmative direction. But at the same time, when you're in that kind of an environment, I was a rifle platoon commander, and then I later took over the company. Mm-hmm. You're really thinking more about how many days you have left, what you have to do that day. It was an extraordinarily difficult environment for the Marine Corps, much more difficult, I think, than even most people in the Vietnam age group fully understand. We took more total casualties in Vietnam than even World War II. We took 103,000 killed or wounded. We lost three times as many dead as in Korea, five times as many dead as in World War I, the Marine Corps did. So, you know, our hands were pretty full. And I, as a platoon and company commander, I was very non-political. I didn't even really think about it. And I actually passed that along to a lot of the young leaders today that I talked to. I've spoken to the Army Infantry School last April, to all of the people in that school, more than 1,000 people. One day I've spoken to a lot of the young Marines coming up, and it's one thing that I try to pass on to them, that when I was 22 years old and I was given this task, the politics of the war were totally beyond anything that I was being required to do. My most important responsibility was to try to do my job and to take care of the Marines that were under my command.
Earlier, David Halberstam said that in some ways this was a defining experience in his life, despite all the other things he's done. You've done an awful lot since Vietnam. Do you still consider it a defining experience in your life?
Oh, absolutely. It took several years for me, of preparation for me, before I went to Vietnam. I started at the Naval Academy in the summer of 1964, right when the Gulf of Tonkin incident occurred. I graduated and got my commission in the Marine Corps right after the Tet Offensive of 1968. So for even, you know, the years before I went to Vietnam, it was on my mind and the mind of people around me constantly. And the impact of the war is of any war is immense, not only on a personal level but on a society. And I've struggled with this, I think, about every way that you can struggle with it, attempting to understand what happened and to help people, South Vietnamese people, you know, Vietnamese Americans, the veterans. It's sort of been one of my I wouldn't call it an avocation, but certainly something that I've been involved in ever since the war. And I guess the conclusion that I've come to is that, like so many other large national experiences, you're never going to resolve this. The best thing you can hope to do is to assimilate it, and it's kind of a different process. When you assimilate something, it stays with you. It just stays with you in a better place.
Is why do you think it continues to resonate so strongly, even to this presidential campaign?
Well, I think all of these major events in our society, in our history, have that impact. I think certainly the Civil War did, the Revolutionary War, the Civil Rights Movement. These things follow a continuum rather than having a beginning and an end, and then. Particularly in this campaign, say as opposed to the last campaign, there are more of these credibility issues that directly impact on what the candidates did during the period. There's a greater demarcation between John Kerry and George W. Bush than there was between Al Gore and George W. Bush.
Mm-hmm. As you, again, going back to the time, and well, I guess throughout, I mean, how did you regard the anti-war protests at the time?
While I was in Vietnam, they were pretty much irrelevant. We never had the, or let me say, I personally never had the feeling that this was something that was a dominant emotion in the age group, and I never really had the comprehension about how the age group had split along educational and in many ways class lines in terms of service and non-service until I left the Marine Corps and went to law school. There are a number of the more extreme activities of the anti-war movement, I think, had a negative impact on what we were trying to do. At the same time, you know, I came over the years to feel very strongly that dissent is a key part of participatory democracy, and you have to accept that. And I certainly have exercised my own right to dissent when it comes to the present war.
All right, you stay with us, too. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to be talking with both David Halberstam and James Webb, and we also want to hear from you. Those of you who remember what it's like living during that period, how do you remember Vietnam and the anti-war movement it inspired? What do you think Vietnam can tell us about the current political landscape, about the two men who are running for president of the United States, about the situation in Iraq, about our politics today and the cultural divide? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And the email address is totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. We'll be back after a short break. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about the legacy and lessons of Vietnam. Our guests are David Halberstam, award-winning author of The Best and the Brightest, among many other books. Most recently, he wrote an article in Vanity Fair magazine called Of War and Presidents. He joins us on the line from Nantucket, Massachusetts. Also with us, James Webb, former Secretary of the Navy under President Reagan, author of himself several books, a platoon and company commander with the Marine Corps in Vietnam. And he joins us by phone from Nashville, Tennessee. Of course, we want to hear from you as well. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Much of the controversy surrounding John Kerry's war record centers on his testimony in 1971, not about his war record, but about his leadership of an anti-war group after his service in Vietnam. He testified before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and John Kerry described how the conflict in South Vietnam created a cultural divide here in the United States.
In 1970, at West Point, Vice President Agnew said, "Some glamorize the criminal misfits of society while our best men die in Asian rice paddies to preserve the freedoms which those misfits abuse." And this was used as a rallying point for our effort in Vietnam. But for us, his boys in Asia, whom the country was supposed to support, his statement is a terrible distortion from which we can only draw a very deep sense of revulsion, and hence the anger of some of the men who are here in Washington today. It's a distortion because we in no way considered ourselves the best men of this country, because those he calls misfits were standing up for us in a way that nobody else in this country dared to, because so many who have died would have returned to this country to join the misfits in their efforts to ask for an immediate withdrawal from South Vietnam. Because so many of those best men have returned as quadriplegics and amputees, and they lie forgotten in Veterans Administration's hospitals in this country, which fly the flag which so many have chosen as their own personal symbol. And we cannot consider ourselves America's best men when we were ashamed of and hated what we were called on to do in Southeast Asia. In our opinion, and from our experience, there is nothing in South Vietnam, nothing which could happen, that realistically threatens the United States of America. And to attempt to justify the loss of one American life in Vietnam, Cambodia, or Laos, by linking such loss to the preservation of freedom, which those misfits supposedly abuse, is to us the height of criminal hypocrisy. And it's that kind of hypocrisy which we feel has torn this country apart.
John Kerry testifying before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee in 1971. James Webb, we've all heard excerpts of that same testimony where he talked about atrocities and other things in Vietnam. Do you think he went too far?
I would have to say that to start off with, this is like the Gordian knot that we may never untie.
Mm-hmm.
There are pieces of things that he says in there that I think most veterans would agree with, but in the aggregate, I would say it's pretty clear that most veterans didn't agree with what he was saying. And the difficulty that people have had, the people who served have had, has not been simply the fact that he said these things, but that he invoked a lot of other people's names in saying it. I was the first Vietnam veteran to work as a full committee counsel in the Congress starting in 1977. And one of the things that we did during the 4 years I was on the Veterans Committee was the most comprehensive survey of Vietnam veterans' attitudes. And it was very carefully done. It was a $6 million survey. We chose the Harris survey, which at that time was the more liberal of the two. The other would be the Gallup that were the dominant survey groups at the time. And the results of that stunned even the individual Vic Fisher, who had guided the survey. They found that 91% of the people who served in Vietnam agreed with the statement that they were glad they served their country. 74% said they enjoyed their time in the military. Nearly 2 out of 3 said they would do it again, even knowing the end result. And as I recall, I think it was 89% agreed with the statement that the difficulty in the war was that we were not allowed to fight it in the proper way. I'm not sitting here advocating that position. I'm just saying that I don't think that what John Kerry was saying at this time really reflected the views of the people around him. And the Vietnam Veterans Against the War, the organization itself, was very small. I once asked the legislative director of Vietnam Veterans Against the War if he could document for me that they had more than 7,000 actual Vietnam veterans in it, and he told me that he could not. So I think that, number one, when we talk about the awards issue that the Swift Boat Veterans for the Truth have been discussing, I want to be clear here myself. I want to be able to say this today. I think that they have been unfair. And it is more a reflection on people's anger with what John Kerry said when he came back than what he did when he was in Vietnam. The awards process has been used against President George Bush the Elder.
Mm-hmm.
It was used against John McCain very unfairly. It was used against Max Cleland, and I think it's being used at this point unfairly against John Kerry. But he does have some homework to do in terms of the people who served with what he said when he came back.
David Halberstam, in your article in Vanity Fair, you wrote that you and others who'd spent a lot of time in Vietnam read and heard John Kerry's testimony, you said it reflected the experiences of many young officers.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think you can find, I mean, I'm not doing a Democratic poll, and I can, by the way, I want to express my esteem for Jim Webb as both a writer. He's not just someone who wrote a couple books, but he's written very good books. And as a political figure who's come out of that terrible tragedy, but I think it was a voice that hit the right note at the right time. I thought that if you read the book that he's done recently with Douglas Brinkley, you can sense the disillusion of someone who, most of whom's contemporaries from that particular class, were choosing not to go. He chose to go, and the disillusion hit him. I think I can understand the anger of some of the veterans, particularly when I think he probably now, in retrospect, and he has apologized, talked about atrocities. I think he's back down. He was sort of more in the center and almost a conservative figure within the Vietnam veterans. But there is a phrase in there that still stays with me, who will ask someone to be the last man to die for a mistake, that I thought was as good a sentence uttered on the war at that time. I mean, I think it has real resonance.
I wanted to ask you also, and then we'll get calls in, I promise, and we're going to take this to most of the rest of the hour, but you also wrote how, David Halberstam, how the war shaped those who didn't go as well as those who did.
Well, I think one of the most, I wrote that article not, and I really made very clear, I don't think that John Kerry is braver than George Bush, or a better patriot, or more courageous. By the way, I hate the denigration of anybody's medals. I think you do it. The medals are done at the time, probably traditionally, and I'm doing a book on the Korean War, and you can find that officers at higher levels get more awards, and the grunts who often do the heavy lifting and are more vulnerable don't get the requisite awards. But the And you can probably make a case that we have diluted some of the awards in later years as our wars have been had more a fragile purchase in terms of the nation's attention and psyche. But I hate anybody's denigration of awards. I really hate what they're doing with those ads. A couple of years ago, when CBS did a thing on Bob Kerry, the senator, and sort of opened up his Congressional Medal of Honor case and used, I thought, very thin evidence against him. One colleague and one VC lady out there, and the anchor man of CBS News did an hour in a prosecutorial tone. I went down and spoke for Bob Kerry, who I barely knew, at his school, which was a almost a lynch mob down there that day, the new school. The point I made in the article was very simply that John Kerry, like so many of us who went, had a better education, that Vietnam was something that you learned from. You were tempered by it. You went. You were, in an odd sense, I don't want to use the word enriched, but you came away different. You shed some of your other baggage, and it was an extraordinary moment. And I felt very strongly that if there were critical people in the Bush administration who had that experience, instead of people who got an awful lot of deferments of the policy on Iraq, might have been different. Mr. Cheney and so many others, including, in a way, the president didn't go because the National Guard was a place where you could keep from going. I think they missed something of a generation in going.
Let's get some callers on the line, and this is Greg. We'll start with him in Shelbyville, Michigan.
Hi, good afternoon, gentlemen.
Good afternoon.
And welcome home, Mr. Webb.
Can you get back to turn that?
Hello, go ahead.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, Greg, you're on the air.
Good afternoon. Couple of things. I agree completely with Mr. Webb about the apolitical nature of people who were serving. At the time, nothing about the war's politics ever crossed my mind during the 16 months I was there. However, I was very aware after a short time that the reason that I had volunteered in serving my country and the reality of what was going on were two completely different things. And Mr. Halberstam's title, The Best and the Brightest, is perfectly apropos for the fact that I realized that we were not being led by the best and the brightest. And after 35 years, and if you watch The Fog of War, you'll find out that we were trusting people to call the shots, and they really didn't have the big picture. But I will mention one more thing about apolitical. My service in Vietnam has made me, sadly, more apolitical, where for 35 years I have refused to take a stand on anything because I would have sided with Mr. Kerry back then. Hmm. I think there's a lot of veterans that have been apolitical for the same reason.
James Webb, speaking of with Greg, and I guess it's that last word of John Kerry's testimony. Was the Vietnam War a mistake?
Well, you know, I have to say I've had a different journey on that, and my short answer would be that certainly the execution of the war, the strategy of the war, was a mistake. I don't believe that the goals were, and it took me a long time to figure that out. When people were asking me in 1978, when Fields of Fire came out, what my feelings of the Vietnam War were, I basically said, I'll tell you, when I figure it out, I'll tell you, I'll take a stand. And I've stayed with this in a way that I think a lot of Americans haven't. I've worked with the Vietnamese community here ever since the late 70s. I've been back to Vietnam many times. I speak Vietnamese. I understand what happened after 1975 when they took a million South Vietnamese and put them into re-education camps, kept 240,000 of them in there longer than 4 years, kept some of them in there longer than 18 years, 56,000 of South Vietnam's young best and the brightest died in re-education camps. That was almost as many as Americans died during the war. And it took the Vietnamese communists a long time. They're now sort of crawling out of the hole that in many ways they themselves dug through the policies that they had, their affiliation with the Soviet Union. They were on the dole from the Soviet Union with the Soviet Union until the Soviet Union collapsed. There are many, many reasons why I believe that what we had in mind, what we were attempting to do, was valid. If I were looking at the Vietnam War in 1971, as this gentleman was talking about, I'd have a hard time disagreeing with the fact that it was going nowhere. And that the leadership of the country had put some pretty flawed strategies into place. And this is what makes it so difficult to talk about the war per se. I think David Halberstam made some really valuable points a couple of minutes ago that sort of illuminate this whole dilemma that people like myself have. I respect John Kerry greatly for stepping forward and serving his country, and I don't care what motive people want to put on that. They can say he had a political dream at that point. Well, maybe John Kennedy did too. He served at a time when most people from his background were not serving, and I think it's an extremely valid point and valuable for us when we look at what's happened in Iraq to look at the people around George W. Bush and see where they were during that era. And to see how, in many ways, either a misunderstanding of what it means to go to war, or I might even want to say an arrogance toward the people who have to go do it, can push policies forward. And that greatly disturbs me.
Greg, thank you very much for the call.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
We're talking about the legacy of Vietnam with David Halberstam and James Webb. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's talk now with Joan in Bethesda, Maryland.
Good afternoon.
Afternoon.
I've been listening to this, but I predate all the people on the program right now. I was in Saigon, then Indochina, in 1954 when the French were there. And that was during the period when Dien Bien Phu fell, and which was the end of the French intervention there. And I talked to a lot of the French, and I flew over the country, and I came back on a ship, or went back on a ship with a group of French soldiers who had been in Vietnam and been in Indochina for many, many years, who were dejected, who were maimed, who had all sorts of physical problems. And it was obvious to those of us, I was working for the U.S. Information Service at that time, it was obvious to those of us that this was not a winnable war. And I don't know what our ambassador said via his cables when he contacted Washington, but all the rest of us felt that this was unwinnable and we should not get involved. Now, this has nothing to do with the poor men who went there and died. I mean, my heart goes out to them. But I do think that we had ample warning, which we did not take.
David Halberstam.
Well, can I add something there? And that is, the great, in terms of the miscalculations, in 1954, when the French were at Dien Bien Phu, there was great pressure for us to come in and help them. And the Army Chief of Staff at that time was one of my great heroes, General Matthew Bunker Ridgway, who had led the 82nd Airborne in World War II in its jump behind lines, who had taken the 8th Army in Korea when it was a defeated army and in 2 months turned it around. He was Chief of Staff then, and he was a very hard man to con. And he sent over an Army survey team to find out what it would take. Let's get beyond just the rhetoric and stuff like that. What does it take? And it was a tough team, and he was a very tough man to go get through on a briefing. He was vicious in tearing stuff apart. It would take, and we were just finished a very unhappy war in Korea, a very unpopular war where we didn't have, by the way, the political problems of Vietnam. It was an old-fashioned border crossing, and we could apply our power appropriately, air and the tanks and artillery. It would take 500,000 to 1 million men. It would take, because the infrastructure was so weak, 50 engineering battalions. It would jump the budget horrendously. It would be a huge change in drafts and in reserve call-ups. And he took, and by the way, he added at the end, unlike Korea, the indigenous population would be hostile. It would not be sympathetic as it had been in Korea. And he took that and he put it on Eisenhower's desk. Eisenhower was the president. And with that, any idea of going to Indochina, helping at the end, and Phu died. And the reason was that it was
David, I'm afraid we're going to have
disproportionate.
David, I'm sorry, I'm going to have to cut you off because we're running out of time in the segment. We'll get back to this after a short break. Joan, thank you very much for the call. More after a break. 800-989-8255. Talk of the Nation, NPR News. Today we're discussing Vietnam and the culture wars it has spurred, including its spillover into the presidential election this year. Our guests are David Halberstam, covered the war for the New York Times, the author of The Best and the Brightest, and James Webb, who served in Vietnam as a platoon and company commander with the United States Marines, former Secretary of the Navy, and the author of several books, including Field of Fire. And they're both with us by phone. If you'd like to join the conversation, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, and the email address is totn@npr.org. David Halberstam, before the break, you were talking about the French experience in...
What we're saying about how much, I mean, that General Ridgway, as Chief of Staff, had put the ticket of what it would take at a very honest level in front of President Eisenhower in 1954, and no one did anything comparable in 1965. I mean, what will it cost? What are the politics of it? Will our troops be effective? Will our technology, our weaponry be effective in this place? And because of that, out of that came a miscalculation, and I think probably it was much harder to tell a president like Lyndon Johnson the truth. Once he, in effect, I think, had a sense of which way he was going to go, and everybody shaved it. They, instead of the high price, they shaved it, as Scotty Reston once wrote in the New York Times, they like salami going in incrementally and hiding the cost of it. And so we never, as a society, judged the cost in a democracy fairly and equitably as to whether it was worth going in.
Let's get another caller on the line, and Mark is with us from Wyoming.
Hi. I'd just like to point out that I believe that John Kerry, the way that he decided to protest the war, is the problem. I believe he dishonored his the people he served with and his countrymen. I think that he tried to get the impression at the time that the United States government was condoning atrocities, and I don't believe that to be the case. You know, we prosecuted the My Lai incident. I don't think that our government sent American troops to, quote, rape and pillage and all the things that he accuses them of. And I think that we're right to question him. I think we're right to question his service, what he did when he was there, and what he did when he came back.
James Webb, John Kerry in that testimony in 1971 did talk about some of the things that Mark was talking about, but he also talked about policies like bombing, like free fire zones, that he said amounted to atrocities in themselves.
I would agree with the gentleman in the sense that as I said before, I think that when John Kerry was welcome to his opinions, but when he was testifying and attempting to sort of say that he was articulating the opinions of everyone who was there, that was the problem. It was using the credibility of his war experience to claim that he was speaking for a lot of people that he wasn't. I think the break, and I think the more important issue right now that we need to get to is something that kind of spins off of what David was just saying. When David was talking about the Ridgway report and the predictions of what it would take in Vietnam, my mind was spinning because when you look at Iraq right now, I think you have a situation that is far more grievous. In Vietnam, we had made a commitment to an incipient democracy. However, people want to debate that, and I don't want to, you know, re-debate the war. And John Kennedy was put in a position in 1961 where when the communist assassination team started re-infiltrating into South Vietnam after they had gone through 4 years of training in the north from 54 to 58, by 1961, they were assassinating 11 government officials a day. And we understand terrorism today in a way that we probably did not then. But if you go back and listen to Kennedy's statement when he started elevating the troops in Vietnam, that was a principal concern of his. Now, when you look at the situation in Iraq preceding this war, there was no direct connection. We had no troops that were vulnerable. We had not made any direct commitments to, quote, the people of Iraq. This administration had a clear decision whether to go in and decapitate a government of a country that was not in any way entangled with us or threatening us. This was totally separate from the war against terrorism and, in fact, strategically worked to the detriment of the war against terrorism. And there were people who, inside the United States military, and I know some of them, who provided the equivalent of a Ridgway report to the people in this administration, telling them what was going to happen in the aftermath. So when others maintain that it was something of a surprise with what has happened after the initial takeover of the Iraqi government, they're wrong. There's not one thing that has happened that was not predictable and was not predicted.
I would certainly agree with that. I mean, I think when Rick Shinseki, the then chief of staff, gave testimony before the Senate about what the potential cost would be in terms of manpower right after they reached Baghdad, and I think used a figure roughly three times of what they have now when everybody has decided that it is too small a figure now. They hammered him. He was the chief of staff. I'd like to go back to the original caller who questioned Senator Kerry on atrocities, because I think it's a very complicated thing. I don't think the American troops did not go out and try and do Cali-like things. I mean, that was, I think, a rare thing. But there were policies that grew out of frustration and an attempt to use technology, and starting with Mr. McNamara's body count, when you put something like body count into play, things will come. My friend John Vann, who was a legendary figure from there, my colleague Neil Sheehan wrote about him in Bright Shining Lie. John was an interesting, complicated man who, in effect, was a great truth teller and the last hawk, really, to be serving the guild. And And John told me once, I think it was around 1970, that there was an American general who had gone through the Mekong Delta with his division. He had a division there. And John's phrase, I can still remember it, like a butcher. And that you would have kills of 600, you know, bodies and five or six weapons. So there were policies that did get carried out, particularly as the war went on in certain areas, free fire zones that were, I think, for all, you know, were extremely ugly and not something that we have much to be proud about. I mean, I think some things got fed into the policy. We're not talking about individual kids and individual units, perhaps, but there were policies from above in a frustrating war that was becoming increasingly bitter that were really things that we would not necessarily want on our conscience.
Well, there's no question, and you know, having been a rifle platoon and company commander in the Anhwa Basin, which was, by the communist count, when I go back to Vietnam, probably the most devastated civilian-populated area of Vietnam during the war. There's a place called Gonoi Island. We arc lighted Gonoi Island when we would not arc light above Vinh. We did not put B-52s on Hanoi until 1972. And there's no question that in that area there was a tremendous amount of suffering, not only from the Americans but also from the other side. We had North Vietnamese operate in there. We had main force Viet Cong units that would hold people in the villages and wouldn't let them move to resettlement areas. When you fight this kind of a war and when the people in the villages are in some sense the hostage and in some sense the prize, it's a very, very sad thing to watch. And that's one of the reasons that I continue to go back to Vietnam. I'm very proud of my service. I'm very proud of the people that I was with, but we were in an area that was where the war was vicious for the people who were living there.
James Webb, former Secretary of the Navy. We're also speaking with David Halberstam about Vietnam. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get another caller on the line. John joins us from Bethlehem, Pennsylvania.
Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I'm from the Lehigh Valley, and the newspapers have been rife with letters to the editor, some op-ed columns. It seems like the last few weeks, instead of really talking about issues going forward, the whole campaign issue is whether or not, you know, John Kerry has dishonored or previously dishonored our country and is not qualified, therefore, to become commander-in-chief. There's one article in particular by a Colonel Deliker, who was a naval pilot, which goes on, part of the emphasis is that Kerry's comments when he returned home, his anti-war involvement, caused the American people to be, how does he put it, to be very, very critical and actually be very, very hostile to the Vietnam veterans. He refers to walking through airports and being castigated. He couldn't, at Penn State University, he would not admit to his having been a soldier. And he's blaming this on Kerry's comments. And number one, I lived through that era, and I don't remember, I remember instances, but not to the level that, they were across the board in the American populace. And whether, and then my real question is, did you, Mr. Webb, experience this hostility? And if yes, if no, do you believe that Kerry's comments caused the American people to be hostile towards Vietnam veterans?
Okay, that's a complicated question, but it's a good one. First of all, the vast majority of the American people love their veterans. And we did surveys when I was on the Veterans Committee, and the Vietnam veterans got a 9.8 on a scale of 10 on what was called a feelings thermometer. There were a lot of incidents, and unfortunately they came from the age group and were heavily concentrated in academia and this sort of thing, where the people who came back were greeted with hostility, they suffered discrimination in attempting to get into graduate schools, different kinds of employment. You wouldn't see that in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, but you would definitely see it along the eastern seaboard and in places on the
West. I believe you can see it in Berkeley.
Yeah, and I have a book coming out in October. This is not a plug. It's called Born Fighting, but it's in the last section of that book, I talk about what happened when I went to Georgetown Law School during this period. This was very real stuff to a lot of people, but it is important to say that the vast majority of Americans love the guys who went to Vietnam.
I think there was a fault line that ran through, and the red and the blue Americas, which exist today, you know, had some of their embryo back there. It was a blue-collar group that fought it and an upper-middle-class college group that protested it, and I don't think some of the college people were particularly genteel in how they went about treating veterans. I think that was a relatively smaller part of the of the whole picture. I mean, I had by good fortune been able to go to Harvard College, and there really was a class line. I think there are probably more people who went to Harvard who won the Pulitzer Prize covering the war than died. I mean, in that sense, it really was died as soldiers. It was different from our other wars. But I don't. First off, you can't. That didn't change because John Kerry said it. I think it was there, and I think Kerry's remarks were around 71 or 72, as I recall. And by then, you know, Nixon was president. The American presence was changing, and we were coming out, and those lines were pretty stratified. I mean, I think the terrible thing is here we are. It's 35 years since Kerry left, and we are debating this, and we're debating his service against an administration where almost no one went, and really some of them consciously did not go. The Attorney General, I think, had six, maybe seven deferments, and they were he really took jobs that got him deferments. It's all, I mean, something's really wrong with this country. If in a time of great need and really serious issues before us, this is so important to us. In the piece in Vanity Fair, I talked about it. It was in 1952 when Dwight Eisenhower ran against Adlai Stevenson. They were debating their respective service, not in World War II, but in World War I, 36 years earlier. I mean,
I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. John, thank you very much for the call. David Halberstam and James Webb, we thank both of you for your time today.
Nice to be with you, Jim. Nice to be with you.
Good to see you. Good to talk to you, David.
Yeah. Both the gentlemen joined us by phone. And in Washington, I'm Neil Conan, NPR News.